Welcome, everyone, to the second live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name's Tammy Simon. I'm the founder of Sounds True, and I'll be your host for this session. In this session, Lisa Wimberger will be teaching on using neuroscience to find healing and happiness. Lisa is broadcasting live from Denver, while I and the Sounds True team are all here in our Boulder studio. Please note that a free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours, and if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now it's my joy and my honor to introduce you to Lisa Wimberger. Lisa is the founder of the NeuroSculpting Institute. She holds a master's degree in education, a foundation's certification in neuroleadership, and certificates in medical neuroscience, visual perception in the brain, and neurobiology. She's the author of New Beliefs, New Brain, and the book NeuroSculpting. As the founder of the NeuroSculpting modality, Lisa runs a private meditation practice in Colorado, teaching clients who suffer from stress disorders and other challenges. Lisa, welcome to the Neuroscience Training Summit with Sounds True. I'm so glad you're part of our summit this year.
Thank you, Tammy. I am thrilled to be here. I'm even more thrilled to talk to all of you today about a very bold statement I made, which is that neuroscience can help us find happiness and healing. This is pretty bold, but I believe this in my heart, and I believe this in my experiences, and I believe this based on what I've seen happen with our students. So I have so much to share with you today. I would love to frame our time together a little bit so you kind of know what to expect. In the first part of this presentation, I'm going to really talk to you about some basic neuroanatomy and help you put some pieces together around the how and the why and the secret language, neuroanatomical language of happiness. And then we're going to talk about some real-time experiences where you can bring in some practices into your day-to-day life to start actually affecting and influencing those patterns. And then we'll have a Q&A session, of course, and I'll answer all of your questions. So let's just jump right in. I have so much to share with you. So the first thing I want to share with you is that there are different kinds of happiness, and I'm not talking about all of the kinds of happiness. So let's get onto the same page and distill a little bit. What kind of happiness are we talking about? You know, we can find happiness through very primal experiences, right? So, you know, if you've just had an amazing meal, you can get lost in the flavors. You can get lost in that euphoric haze that happens when you have a good meal. That's a primal sort of happiness. And that happens in a very, that's dominated more by a very particular part of the brain. There's also the kind of happiness we can have if we're in love and we've actually made love and we have all these endorphins and we're in that afterglow. These are very real sorts of happinesses, but they're not the kind I'm talking about today. So I just want to let you know the kind of happiness that I'm talking about is more of an evaluative happiness, the kind of happiness that we carry with us long after those moments have disappeared, the kind of happiness that leads to our perceptions of the world, the kind of happiness that leads to how we expect the world to show up for us. This is the kind of happiness that is independent of the external world. It's created from inside, and it's something that we actually have choice around versus a flavor that just lights up our taste buds. That's more externally created. So we're going to dive into the choice of happiness in those perceptions and in those ways we choose to show up in the world, even when the outside world is not giving us wonderful experiences. This is the harder kind of happiness, at least in my experience. And I was blessed many years ago to leave the pursuit of happiness in one realm and redirect it into another, right into the neuroscience field. And I say I was blessed to do that because what neuroscience gave me was the secret language of happiness that up until that point, all of my wishing, praying, and hoping didn't really bring me. So let's help you understand that there is a method to the madness, so that you're wishing, hoping, and praying. If that doesn't actually manifest into happiness, you've got another tool to actually manifest happiness. You've got science. So let's dive in. The kind of evaluative happiness that I'm talking about really hinges upon a baseline feeling of safety. And there's all sorts of studies that show that when we feel a sense of safety, maybe for me, safety means feeling that my environment is supportive. Maybe for you, safety means feeling like you've got a full refrigerator. Maybe for you, it's safety means you know where you're sleeping that night. When we have a foundational sense of safety, what we then get to do is layer on top of that perceptions. And we get to filter the world coming in as a more positive experience. When we don't have a foundation of safety, then even if a positive experience is coming at us, we may not filter it that way. We may filter it from a foundation that says something is wrong here. I don't feel safe. So happiness and the cultivation of health stems from a perception of safety, whether that perception is real or cultivated. And let's talk about where that comes from, because I believe if you understand a little bit about the embryology of this, you will understand that you're not fundamentally broken if you're not happy. You're actually efficient. It just so happens you're efficient in some ways that don't really support you. What do I mean? I mean this. I'm going to use my brain for a second here. So this is a brain model, right? This is what we have in our heads. Every one of us has this. And this brain is developing in our early fetal development. So I want to talk to you about how this happens. When we start developing as a fetus, we start as a cluster of cells. And this cluster of cells soon turns itself into a plate and then a tube. This tube very quickly becomes the spinal column. And if we were to turn this sideways, you see the very edge here of the brainstem. The spinal column is this length all the way beneath it. So as we're growing in fetal development, if you would consider ourselves little flowers, we're growing from a stem. And that stem eventually gets a little bulbous top, and then eventually a bud. And I would venture to say that that bud is equivalent to the midsection of the brain. So I'm going to open up my brain for you and show you what I mean. So what we're looking at here is the right hemisphere, the inside of the right hemisphere. If I'm growing in fetal development and I'm growing this cord, which is eventually going to become the brainstem, the bud of this flower that I'm becoming may very well be this center part of the brain. But then that bud gets to flower. And that's the last part that happens. It blooms and it blossoms into its full radiant beauty. And when it blooms and blossoms, it becomes this outer rind. And this outer rind is called the cortex. And it's represented in most brains that we've seen as all of these squiggles. When that flower blossoms into its full beauty, that's us ready. Our brain's ready, it's developed, and we are soon to be born. But here's the interesting thing. That doesn't happen right away. So there's a sequence to things. In early first trimester, we are developing the spinal cord and the bud, which is actually midbrain. What does that mean? It means that early on in our fetal development, with this bud wired up and this brainstem all linked up, we've got access to autonomic processes like breathing and heart beating and things like that. But we also have access to our stress center, which is roughly governed by midbrain. So that means we've not yet budded into our beautiful radiant selves, but we actually have the ability to process stress. So if mom is stressed, then we have the wiring to process those hormones in an efficient way. That means by the time we are born, we perhaps are quite efficient at processing stress, which is really processing threat-based stimulus. So we're cooked, we're ready, we're born, and we're skilled at processing stress. But what about all this blooming I'm talking about? What about this beautiful cortex? Yes, we are born with a cortex, but it is not yet wired up. So let me give you the example of, let's say the cable guy is coming to your house to give you cable, and he delivers the router, the remote control, and the modem, and he leaves it on your doorstep. Can you watch cable? No, but you've got the hardwiring. It's just not linked together. So we are born with the modem, the router, and the remote control of our radiant self, but they're not yet linked. So we have to spend time linking these things so that our beautiful radiant self, our choice to be happy, our compassionate self, our joyful self, our creative self, our patient self, our generous self, that takes some time and investment and wiring up. So here we are born skilled at processing stress. And looking at the parts and pieces of our cable box in front of us saying, I don't think I'm going to access all of these great channels anytime soon, but I can process stress, so I've got that going for me. So what we're really talking about is understanding that we are born efficiently using our stress center, and that we need, let's say, almost a quarter of a century of life's experiences and rich nutrition and wonderful emotional connections and great sleep patterns to actually make this flower bud bloom to its full capacity. So that means, from neuroscience's estimation, our ability to choose happiness is most mature and most accessible to us almost a quarter of a century after we've been accessing our threat response, filtering the world through negativity, threat, and fear. This leads me to the inevitable conclusion that if I can't choose happiness over fear, it is not because I am broken, and it is surely not because you are broken. It is because you are efficient based on your wiring. And I want you to hear me say that one more time. You are not broken because you can't choose happiness. You're just efficient based on your wiring. And that can be rewired. And that is what we are talking about today. You know, so many times I come away from great motivational events that I go to, and I listen to amazing speakers speak, and that motivation is a euphoria, and it lasts for just a little while. And then I look around at my own space, and maybe you look around at your own space, and you say, well, I still have that stress, and I still have that bill, and I still have that relationship, and I still have that addiction, and I still have that depression or that anxiety or whatever your situation is. And then we feel like, how come they can do it and I can't? And many of us, once that motivation euphoria wears off, can feel worse than we did before we went to that motivational event. Because now we start comparing ourselves to all these accomplishments, thinking they became happy because they made a choice, and somehow I can't make that choice. That's not true. I'll tell you how they became happy, whether they know it or not. They became happy because they put in time, investment, and practice. Just like we learn to wire to stress in utero because of time, investment, and practice. A quarter of a century of time, investment, and practice. Now, that doesn't mean that the front of our brain and that cortex wasn't somewhat developing simultaneously. It just means it was not near maturity. So, for instance, if the front of the brain is the section of the brain that we have measurable data now that correlates to getting very active when we are feeling compassionate and we are feeling empathy and we are feeling states of joy and flow states of creativity and high production and motivation and goal setting and all of that that equates to our higher sense of happiness. What we're noticing is that we have little tastes of this throughout these early 20 plus years of development. But that those little tastes get exhausted so quickly because that wiring is so complex. Imagine the wiring necessary to compute and evaluate and then act upon that which is intangible. Motivation is not tangible or measurable. It's a felt sense, and it's something we have to cultivate. However, eating food and feeling full is tangible. So there's a stark difference in the wiring necessary to compute tangible happiness versus intangible happiness. And we're on this mad chase, chasing like butterflies, intangible happiness. So I'm going to bring it back to what the mystics say. It's cultivated from the inside. But that doesn't help any of us who don't know how to cultivate it. So the clues are science-based. The clue is, first, stop beating yourself up. You're wired and predisposed to seek out threat and to protect yourself from it. And this is a life-saving gift. So let me back up. This limbic system, this threat-based system, I do not want to vilify. The midbrain is the reason we are all alive. It's the reason we're talking right now. It's the reason you ducked precisely at the right moment when a sharp object came flying by. It's the reason you jumped out of the way of a speeding car. It is the reason you protected yourself precisely at the most vulnerable moment where you got out of that situation by the skin of your teeth. It's a gift. And that's why we develop it first. But it's overused and it's burdened. And it's very efficient, so it wants to protect us. And because we've used it from the beginning, it thinks it needs to protect us all the time. And this cortex, this prefrontal cortex, the part all the way in the front, that hasn't been used from day one. It's something we cultivate, and if we don't cultivate it, well, then why would it be ready and efficient for us to use? So how do we cultivate this so that we can bring this sense of happiness more online? Well, we cultivate it in many, many ways. And step one in cultivating happiness based on a science perspective is we quiet down this part, the middle. Because what we know from science is that the front of the brain and the middle of the brain have a very interesting relationship in terms of how they use blood, oxygen, and glucose. You remember the seesaw that we all used to sit on in the playground when we were kids, where if that seesaw was nice and balanced, well, then all potential exists, the potential for one side to go up or one side to go down. So if the front of the brain and the middle of the brain are in this balance, at neutral, at rest, well, then we are poised to use our stress center if need be, or move into a cultivated sense of our higher self, compassion, joy, empathy. At neutral, we are poised to use either. This is prime. However, the minute one side goes up and spikes activity in that seesaw relationship, the other side goes way down. So the moment we are stressed, activity in the middle of the brain goes way up, and activity in the front of the brain goes way down. That means in any moment where we are stressed, we literally cut ourselves off from accessing to our full capacity the parts of the brain that can give us joy, empathy, compassion, forgiveness, creativity, problem solving, all of these things that we actually need to help us move out of that response. So by that same equation, the reverse is true. If the activity in the front of the brain can be cultivated and excited manually, then activity in the negative stress-based threat center will actually quiet. So I want you to understand this critical science equation here so that we don't just rely on wishing, hoping, and praying, which are all wonderful things. I wish and hope and pray every single day. But that we use some science to help support that and say, if I am stressed, the only thing I really need to do is reach for some tools to start the quieting of the stress center. I'm just going to wait. There was an ambulance. If I can quiet the activity in that stress center, then what happens is by default, by that seesaw equation, the front of the brain starts to get active. I start to get back in touch with the ways I can reach for my happiness, the ways I can choose happiness. So I want to give you the first practice, the first tool, which is that in any moment of stress, one of the fastest ways I know to quiet that response and start pushing blood, oxygen, and glucose back to the front of the brain is to literally shake. Twitch, shake vigorously, because what's going on when you're stressed? Your muscles are contracting. And evolutionarily, they're contracting because they think you're supposed to run or fight a predator, run from a predator or fight a predator. But that's not happening when you've gotten an email in all capital letters from your ex. You're not going to fight that physically, and you're not going to run from that physically, but your body's going to still prepare to do that. So the muscles are contracting whether we like it or not. We have to dissipate that contraction so that eventually those muscles can soften and we can access our amazing messenger system, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, and send a message to the brain that says, we're good, muscles are soft. And that can quiet that mid-center, and we can start ushering resources to the front of the brain and start once again choosing for motivation and happiness and seeing a bigger picture, because we all get tunnel vision when we're stressed, and that doesn't help us choose happiness, but this equation gives us this opportunity. So I'm going to make a recommendation to you to shake vigorously every single day as a practice. And most definitely after you're stressed or during stress, if you have an opportunity to actually go shake. And you don't have to shake for long periods of time. It can be vigorously for a whole minute. Believe me, a minute of vigorous shaking brings a warm flush back to the midline of the body. And then you start to go back to rest and digest and dissipate that arousal contraction. And then our two-way messenger system starts to communicate back to the brain that everything is fine. So I want to talk a little bit about this two-way messenger system, which I'm only going to briefly mention because you'll get to hear from the master himself, Dr. Stephen Porges, all about the system. He's the current authority on the vagus response. So I don't dare speak about it in any depth, but I do want to introduce this idea to you that we have a bundle of nerves that acts as a two-way highway. And this bundle of nerves, the vagus nerve, which is actually, it's a bundle, actually comes out of this section of the brainstem. So it's a brainstem origin point. And this bundle of nerves runs the whole length of the spinal column. And its job is to deliver messages from brain to body and then command heart rate, lungs, digestion, and the innervation of all of our organs. And it takes sensory information from the body and then delivers it back up to the brain. It's a two-lane highway. Now, I said earlier that happiness comes from a sense of safety initially. If we can manage threat, then we're safe. And if we're safe, then we get to choose happiness. So this two-way highway regulates our perception of safety. When we are safe, whether literally or we're just perceiving we're safe, then this two-lane highway keeps our heart rate nice and even, keeps our breathing long, slow, and deep. It keeps the appropriate response. It keeps our digestion happening, keeps our bowels regular. When this two-lane highway gets a stress signal either through the body or from the brain, it's going to use its two-lane highway to mobilize us or immobilize us to deal with this. So in order for us to ever, ever have a hope of having dominant activity in the front of the brain to access our greatest idea of happiness, we must have a healthy, functioning two-lane highway that knows how to cultivate safety and adapt us accordingly. And when we are stressed, this two-lane highway needs to be able to adapt us fairly quickly after the stress is gone to bring us back to safety. This two-lane highway is developed early on in our fetal development. So let's put some pieces together here. We're wired for stress. We're wired to tune to safety. And the moment we don't perceive it, the whole body, from brain to body and body to brain, is going to be in a threat response. And we are going to cut off access to the choice to be happy. So somatically, physically, going into this beautiful system we have and unlocking its contraction will start to send messages back through the body and up to the brain that we are safe. And then we can move into the choice for happiness. So really what I'm getting at is that to choose happiness, it's a somatic practice, it's a mental practice, and it's a daily practice of time and investment. So let's talk a little bit about what we can do for our daily practice, and then we'll go into some more nuances of this system. The first thing, as I mentioned, was shaking every single day. You cannot shake, and you can contract and hold your stress and let it linger, which is what most of us do because we're not taught otherwise, or you can address it somatically in the moment, move it quickly, and have a moment of going back to safety and having a moment of sparking the front of the brain. Another thing we can do to bring online a sense of greater access to the front of the brain is we can fuel the brain with its prime optimal fuel. What is prime optimal fuel for the brain? Well, it's really three things. I'm going to talk briefly about nutrition. It is a balance of healthy carbohydrates so that our neurons and really all the cells in the body have fuel, glucose, to convert into life energy, which some of us call chi. So we need healthy carbohydrates for brain functioning and all cellular functioning. And we've had a bad rap on carbohydrates. So let me just tell you, the faster that sugar goes in, the less sustainable it is. We don't want fast sugar. That's not good. And that's what most of us think of when we think of carbohydrates. We think of grains, refined sugars, and those are considered the bad carbohydrates. What are good carbohydrates? Well, vegetables. And many of us don't actually know vegetables are carbohydrates. So I'm going to tell you, we need carbohydrates, but we need them in vegetable form. And that's going to give our brain cells the fuel it needs so that we don't default exhausted to our efficiencies, which are stress-based. We have the fuel to motivate to our more complex computations, which is intangible happiness. So we actually need vegetables. We also need proteins to build structures. And according to the brain, what are brain structures? Neurotransmitters. Our chemical messengers are proteins. And without eating protein, we do not make our essential amino acids, which become our neurotransmitters. So if we are protein deficient, are we going to cultivate a sense of happiness? No, because we're probably not going to have a regulation around the way our body uses things like, or makes things like serotonin and dopamine and tryptophan and GABA and glutamate and all these things we need in line to choose for happiness. So we need to eat protein. And the third piece of this nutrition equation is that we need to eat fats, plain and simple. Why? Because the brain is made of 60% fat. So we must consume healthy fats to help the brain sustain itself in predominantly what it's made of. So here's the next practice for you. The next practice for you, after you shake every single day and get that into a regular practice, the next practice for you is to look at what is on your plate. Do you have healthy fat, a healthy protein, and a healthy carbohydrate that fits perfectly with your lifestyle choice? So if you are a vegan, a vegetarian, or an omnivore, you can make your plate have a carbohydrate, a protein, and a fat. So this is more about what fits your lifestyle choice, but doing it smart. Because if you get your nutrition in line, then again, what you have is the building blocks necessary for the higher level activity needed in the front of the brain, which is, again, how we cultivate happiness. So we've got a couple of somatic approaches. We've got a physical practice. We've got a nutrition guideline. And now we get to thought influence, which is really the specialty of what we do here with neurosculpting. We help people influence, edit, and direct their thoughts. And this is called self-directed neuroplasticity. It really just means our ability to learn something new in this moment and make the choice to remember this situation. If I'm paying full attention to this moment, then I will remember it better than if I'm multitasking, right? You know this. I mean, if you're multitasking right now, you probably just said, wait, what did she say? And if you're paying full attention, you probably heard what I said. It's the same in all of life. So we are required to access our neuroplasticity. We are required to have full attention. And full attention only is available to us when we have resources in the front of the brain giving us a rise of learning neurotransmitters that help us focus. So you start to see that the physical and the nutritional building blocks coincide with our ability to direct our thoughts. And one of the things that I was so grateful to neuroscience for was it helped me bridge my very deep spiritual practice and my decades of metaphysical training with the body needs. And up until that point, I didn't address the body needs. In fact, I was a very practiced person in the idea that I am not this body. I am more than this body, which is true, but it caused me to ignore this body and sit through pain instead of ask the question, what is that pain asking me to do for it? So neuroscience told me that to gain a sense of happiness, a cultivated happiness, I needed to support my body as much as my mind. So how do we support the mind and the thoughts? Well, we first recognize that incessant negative thoughts comes from that efficient wiring that we already talked about. So one of the first things we can clue in on is if that wiring perceives it's not safe, then I will have a very negative threat-based attitude. So if I am feeling a whole bunch of negativity, one of the first things I can do to start changing my thoughts is to look around my immediate environment and start making lists of all the things in my immediate vicinity that I equate to comfort or safety. For instance, right now, let's say my day was terrible. Let's say I got some horrible news, but I look around the space that I'm in right now and I say, well, you know what? Right now, I'm on solid ground. My breath is consistent. I have my teacup with some tea in case I'm thirsty. I have a full belly. And I know when I go home in a little while that I will have food in my refrigerator. Okay. I make a list of the tangible things in my immediate vicinity that equate to comfort or safety. Even if it's as simple as I'm in my car and the door is locked and no one can bother me for 2.5 minutes. If we start making those lists of safety items or comfort items, what we're doing is we're talking to that embryological first system. We're going right to midbrain and we're saying, you're okay. You're okay. And that midbrain is going to start checking off its list of things it hypervigilantly is looking to find fault with. And it's going to say, okay, right now I'm okay. And then we're going to have that two-way highway start to communicate to the body to relax. We can also go into an embrace, like cross our arms around our shoulders and feel an embrace that can signal from the body up to the brain, safety and comfort. So the first self-directed neuroplastic approach we can take in any moment is to lock on, however small or large, to a list of comfort and safety in that one moment. And what that does is something miraculous. And this is the first step of neurosculpting, is to make that list. But the thing that that does, when you make that list, you are feeding this part of the brain what it needs to relax. That side of the seesaw comes down. And the side of the seesaw that activates the front of the brain goes up. Because remember, we said those two things are connected. So the moment you focus on your comfort and your needs being met in just this one moment with this one breath, with this one small environment, then you are bringing resources to the front of the brain and you are literally bringing online your opportunity to see a bigger picture, choose for empathy, compassion, grace, generosity, patience, forgiveness, and all of this you can direct to yourself. You could forgive yourself, be patient with yourself, be generous with yourself and others simply because you made that list. I cannot emphasize that list enough. Step one in the neurosculpting process is to marinate in a list of ways in which your basic needs are safe and comforted in this one moment. Later, the mind can go to letting your thoughts go and resting in bliss. You can't get there in the front of the brain until you address the activity in the middle of the brain. So the first step of our neurosculpting process to reframe thoughts and entrain them differently is to make that list. And we usually do it here at the Institute in a meditative space where I'm guiding that for you, but you get to guide yourself in any moment. So that's step one of directing your thoughts. Step two of directing your thoughts is to then lock yourself in to activity in the front of the brain. Well, how does that work? The beautiful thing that neuroscience has given us is data that shows us how to increase activity in the front of the brain. And what we've discovered, I say we, but neuroscientists discovered this, I just read it and I'm relaying it to you, is that when we think of things that are novel, we get lost in curiosity or wonder or humor, we have dominant activity measurable in the front of the brain. So this is another amazing piece of the equation. If you can cultivate thoughts, however brief, that are curious by nature and safe, or humorful, then you can lock into the front of the brain. So what kind of thoughts are those? Okay, I'm going to give you a perfect example. Let's say I am stressed and in the moment. I'm going to do step one. I'm going to make my list of how I am safe in this one moment. And I'm going to start bringing activity down in the midbrain. And I'm going to make activity available in the front, but I need to lock in there. So immediately after I marinate in that list, I am going to give my prefrontal cortex what I call brain candy. I'm going to give myself brain teasers. Okay, Lisa, what is the most crazy, interesting shape I could think of right now in this moment? Gee, I don't know. Let me take a second to think about it. Oh, it's got squiggles. Oh, it's got sharp edges. What is my name spelled backwards and how might that sound? Oh, that's interesting. Let me see. Or, if I could invent a new animal that never existed before, I wonder what I could invent. These are random, constructed, nonsensical thoughts. But if you fire these kinds of curiosity prompts to the front of your brain, you will lock activity into the front of the brain more and keep yourself out of slipping back into that negative space. Any opportunity you can find to tease your curiosity, however nonsensical or benign it might be, is an opportunity to exercise the front of your brain, which, believe me, needs a lot of exercise because it's got 25 years of wiring to catch up to before it gets to an equal contender for that midbrain. So I'm going to give you some more practices around exercising the front of the brain. I like brain teasers. I like to make my own thoughts around it. So here is a series of thoughts that I use to pull myself into the front of my brain. I create shapes. I invent colors. I don't see them. I just imagine them. I try to spell words backwards. I try to count by 3.5s or 4.25s. That's a brain teaser. I try to make up and invent words. Or if you don't feel creative, no worries. You can use your hands and your feet to do the same thing. So for instance, if I want a moment of curiosity in my brain, I may reach for my teacup with my non-dominant hand. In fact, I may turn it so that every time I reach for it, I have to use my non-dominant hand to grab a side that's interesting and not quite familiar. I will stir my tea in the opposite direction. I will eat my meal with the fork in the non-dominant hand. I will brush my teeth with my non-dominant hand. Any time you want to pop yourself into that prefrontal cortex and give yourself exercise to help robustly build your access to happiness, you can do a non-dominant limb exercise that's safe and easy. So let's back up a moment and recap this. To self-direct your happiness, you must have a primed brain. And that brain must be primed to have activity available in the front. That requires step one, quieting the middle by making your list of safety. Step two, anchoring into the activity in the front by cultivating exercises or mental thoughts that are curious or full of awe or even full of humor. You can tell yourself a joke. So in these first two steps, what is really happening with these two simple steps is that you are taking an evolutionary relationship between midbrain and front of the brain, and you are saying to it, I understand you, I know what you're doing and why, and I'm here to tell you, I don't need the midbrain loud right now, I want the front of the brain active right now. This is all self-directed, and it seems awfully simple when I say it like this. It seems like, Lisa, how can really just cultivating these interesting thoughts and making that list work for me? And I will tell you, because in the crisis world, the first thing we do is bring people into the present moment and let them know, you're breathing, you're safe, I've got you. It's an intuitive response. We know this works. And science has now met us there and said, yes, it does. In fact, in the crisis world, getting someone present to the moment helps downregulate that midbrain quite a bit. And we know from fMRI studies that activity in the front of the brain spikes when we are dealing with interesting, curious, novel ideas and thoughts. So the beautiful thing about science is that it gives us these equations. But there's even more to the story. That is a brain primer. But now, with the brain primed, if you actually spent even just a couple moments detailing, envisioning, imagining a positive story, then what you're doing is you are strengthening a positive story with a receptive brain versus trying to reach for a positive story when your brain is not receptive and it's in contraction and it's in that fight or flight state. Then reaching for that positive story just ends up in failure. And then we walk away saying, well, I tried that mantra and it just didn't work. Well, because you tried it against a midbrain volume. You didn't try it after you primed your brain. The mantra is not the primer. The mantra is what you get to reinforce and strengthen after you've primed your brain. And so what I want to also say to some of you out there is, I know some of you beat yourselves up because your positive affirmations don't change your life. And then you walk away feeling like a failure. And I'm going to tell you, they do work, but maybe you weren't taught how to prime your brain first. So stop beating yourself up and stop trying to make your mantras work when your brain hasn't come online. It's like a salmon has to swim upstream, and that's really difficult. And they do it with all of their might. And we do it with all of our might. We search for happiness with all of our might against a current. We have to go with the current. And the current is prime the brain first. Then dive into those mantras. Dive into the statements of the world is beautiful. Dive into those statements of I am a generous person. Or wow, my life is wonderful, or whatever your mantra is, your positive affirmation, say it after you've primed your brain, because then your neurology will believe it, you will buy it, and you will reinforce it, and then you will store it in your memory as something tangible. And the more you repeat it, this is what I said earlier, time investment and repetition. The more you repeat the positive stories, the bigger they grow, the realer they get. And I'm sure Dr. Rick Hansen talked about that, and he talks about this all the time, is growing the good, cultivating the positive. And you only cultivate that when your midbrain is quiet, because anything you input into your field of perception, when that midbrain is loud and in threat mode, will be filtered as a threat, stamped even with that theme. So the beautiful thing, again, about science is that it has given us these equations. So let's take a moment and review a whole bunch of tools that are available to you for free in your tool bag. The first tool is shaking to tell the body contraction to use it and dissipate it so the body can tell through that two-lane highway, the brain, it's okay, we can relax now. The second thing is to look at what is on your plate. Am I consuming the fuel I need for happiness, the structure I need for happiness, and the fat I need for happiness, the carbohydrates, the proteins, and the fats? Am I consuming them in a balanced way? No? Well, then I'm a salmon swimming upstream. And then the third tool is the equation between midbrain and front. And that tool is list how you are safe and comfortable in just this one moment. And you'll start to quiet that midbrain. The fourth tool is to start generating brain teasers of novel, curious ideas and thoughts, or doing things with your non-dominant hand or leg that make you say, oh, that's interesting, so that we can beef up activity in the front of the brain. And those two steps are the brain primer. From that space, anything is possible. From that space, reframing your disease, your addiction, your depression, your financial problems, your relationship problems, everything is reframable from that primed space. Now, does that mean it's easy? Absolutely not. And does that mean that your sudden financial lack is going to turn into abundance? No, it doesn't. But it means you're going to have a choice in that moment to see something you haven't seen before, which may lead you to the problem solution, which may lead you to the joy and the compassion you need to push yourself one more day, or the motivation. It has to come from a stable built foundation that revolves around us feeling safe so that we can move into the front of the brain. And even though this sounds like a simple list of things you might have even heard before, I promise you, if you put these tools into your day-to-day in practice, and you do this every day as repetition and investment over time, you will physiologically change the function and structure of your brain. You will push the front of the brain into a more dominant state of activity, which literally means your neurons and their dendritic reach are growing networks. You're increasing the volume in the front of the brain is what you're doing by using it. And you will literally start coming into homeostasis in the body. You may even see things like increased nutrient absorption, bowel regulation, lower heart rate, a deeper breath, maybe even blood sugar regulation. Inflammation comes down. All of this happens when we perceive safety and get the front of the brain all excited so that it can access joy, compassion, empathy, big picture thinking, motivation, goal setting, creative problem solving, and those flow states that are so important to us feeling like, yeah, I'm in it, I'm doing it, it's happening. So these practices together are simple, but they're very powerful. And I'm hoping that you take some of these and you put them into your day-to-day life. Thank you.
Lisa, thank you so much. And I'd like to let all of our viewers know that if you're interested in asking Lisa Wimberger a question, you can do so now. What you can do is type your question in the dialogue box that appears directly under the video player, and then just hit submit, and your question will find its way to me here in the Sounds True studio. We've already received several questions from viewers, and let's get right to it. The first question here is a clarification that Gabrielle writes. She says, I understand how shaking discharges fear, and relaxes the muscles in the body. But I missed understanding how it shifts dominant activity to the front of the brain. Can you help me understand that?
Yes, great question. So when we dissipate the contraction in the muscles and we move back into rest and digest, we have blood, oxygen, and glucose moving back to the midline of the body, which then lowers the heart rate, deepens the breath, and kicks digestion back up. That visceral change signals communication back up to the brain through that two-lane highway that we're safe. So then what happens is midbrain activity comes down. And because that is inversely related to the prefrontal cortex, activity in the front of the brain becomes available and sometimes even spikes. So that's a great question. When we're contracted in arousal, we literally have diverted blood, oxygen, and glucose away from the midline, the gut, and our organs, so that we are perceiving threat until those resources come back to midline. And dissipating the contraction allows those resources to no longer need to fuel the muscles. So the resources go back to midline, which then sends the signal back up to the brain.
And we have a question here from David, who writes, how do ketones affect the relationship between the front and middle brain?
You know, Dr. David Perlmutter is the leading authority on a lot of the work with ketones and food. But basically, when you stop eating carbs, you start to burn, I believe it's muscle for ketones, for energy. And I'm going to put that question in terms of, I would suggest you check out Dr. David Perlmutter's work, but his recommendation is that going to burning ketones as fuel in the brain once a month is a powerful regenerative process for the front of the brain. And so his recommendation is fasting one day a month, I believe, don't quote me on that, to move away from burning fat to burning ketones as fuel. But that I don't know that that's a suggested sustained diet unless you are a seizure patient, in which case a ketone diet is very helpful for those on a seizure protocol.
Okay, Lisa, and since you mentioned that shaking is part of our daily practice now, Janice writes in, what about jumping on a trampoline? Is that as good as shaking?
You know what? That's wonderful and joyful. I would say that any kind of vigorous cardio that you can do to help dissipate it works. But let's say you're in the car and you're stressed because something happened or you just got some news and you don't have time to get on that trampoline until 10 hours later. Or you don't have a trampoline, then I would say shake in the moment. So shaking is the go-to response when your preferred cardio output is not available to you. And I like shaking because it only takes a minute. Whereas if I want to really dissipate some of that charge through a cardio process, I kind of have to build up to it. So you're probably going to need to spend, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes on the trampoline, which is a lot of fun, really. But again, if you're stressed at work and you're in between meetings, but there's a bathroom stall, well, you can go there and shake. The general recommendation is, I think, roughly like 20 minutes of cardio a day to keep kind of a nice stress regulation. But I do the shaking intermittently throughout the day. And in fact, there's a wonderful process called tremor release exercises that you can Google that and see some instruction videos, very powerful method of formalized kind of shaking.
Now, Lisa, let's say somebody is moving into a fear state, they can recognize it, and they're in a meeting at work, or they're in some kind of situation where at that moment, it really doesn't work to excuse themselves and go shake someplace. Do you have anything you can recommend on the spot in that moment when someone recognizes they're starting to be afraid?
Yes. And it's the old, I'm sure we've all heard this, you know, those people who have fear of public speaking are told to envision everyone in the audience naked. That's a prefrontal moment. So I'm not saying you should envision those in the business meeting naked. But if you could envision something either humorous or outlandish in that moment, that can help moderate. It might not last long, but it can help moderate you a little bit by bringing you into the front of the brain. So maybe you can imagine, I wonder if a bird flew in here and sat on that person's head, what that might look like. Or, gee, I wonder if that person did the meeting standing on their head, how interesting that might be. Just these quick little outlandish novel thoughts can interrupt that moment of midbrain activity, maybe even enough to give you a pause where an exhale happens, and that pause may linger. But I would say go to those things in the moment, because we can't always excuse ourselves to shake.
Will writes in, how does meditation fit into the brain conditioning that you're describing here in this session?
I would say meditation is such a vast term. I call neurosculpting meditation. So for me, meditation starts the moment I make my list of safety. That's meditation to me. And then meditation deepens as I move into the front of the brain. And meditation exponentially expands when I've primed my brain and now I get to cultivate positive thoughts. So it's such a broad term that I would say, really, any approach you take to regulating your own brain state, in my world, is a form of meditation. And other meditations all do different things. I mean, we've seen Tibetan monks go through fMRI scans, and their compassion meditation puts them in one part of the prefrontal cortex. Their joy meditation puts them in another part. So different meditations affect the brain differently. There's, mantra meditation that you vocalize will actually engage other parts of the brain. So it's such a big term that I really believe any empowerment we have to navigate our own brain is a form of meditation. And to not limit ourselves to having meditation have to look like one particular modality, and that meditation doesn't have to look like the achievement of bliss and joy. It can simply look like I've downregulated my negativity two notches right now. That is meditative for many people. And that's a great question.
I have an interesting question here from Mitch, who writes in, any thoughts on nootropics?
I get asked that question all the time. I do not know enough about nootropics. I can't speak to them. I know so much more about nutrition, just consuming foods as brain regulatory influence, but I don't know enough about them.
Okay, very good. How does neurosculpting work on hormonal imbalance like hyperthyroidism or irregular heartbeats?
That depends. What neurosculpting can do is, because it downregulates stress hormones, it can actually downregulate inflammation. Now, if hormonal imbalances are worsened by body inflammation, then neurosculpting can mitigate that way. Can neurosculpting change the amount of hormones a gland produces? I would not say that. But what I would say is that what we know is that all disease is inflamed by stress. Whether it's cured by curing stress or not, we don't know. But all disease is inflamed and made worse by stress. So if we can regulate stress hormones at will and decrease cellular inflammation, which is a byproduct of decreasing stress hormones, then we can bring down body inflammation, which may mitigate quite a lot of symptoms. But I don't know that it could change the thyroid production unless that production was inhibited by the stress itself.
We have a question here from Katerina, who writes in, can you describe if there is a difference between feeling safe and being in a comfort zone?
I don't know that there is a difference. I think when I perceive I'm in my comfort zone, that equates to a version of feeling safe for me. Wait, let me clarify that. I could be in an uncomfortable situation that's out of my comfort zone and feel really disturbed, but then I look around and I can start to make my list of, well, at least in this new, strange, uncomfortable environment, I know where the exit is. I know where the bathroom is. So I would say, yeah, that's a great question. They are different. You can map to safety even outside of your comfort zone by taking in the aspects of the environment that you possibly can that make you feel that your basic needs are met. So here's a great example. I know a woman who gets anxiety flying on an airplane only if she's more than two rows away from the bathroom. So flying is totally outside of her comfort zone. But if she can see the bathroom door, that becomes a safety for her. And she's okay to fly as long as she's in those specific rows. So that's an example of being outside of your comfort zone, but mapping to your basic needs being met in that one moment, and then you kind of mitigate the stress in that moment.
Lisa Christina writes in, what about breathing techniques to temper the midbrain?
Absolutely. Breathing is so critical. It's such a big topic that I didn't even have time to get into it. But if we access a deep breath, we are directly communicating with that two-lane highway. In particular, the inhale, if the inhale is longer than the exhale, we tend to arouse the system. And when you're in stress, that's not what you want to do. So when we're in stress in arousal, we want longer exhales, because the longer we exhale, the more carbon dioxide we produce, which actually starts to relax the muscles and send the signal back up to the brain that we're safe. So longer exhales to calm arousal. But if you're the opposite of arousal, if you're paralyzed in fear, then you want a longer inhale. But there's entire curricula on how to breathe. And it's one of our gifts. But in neurosculpting, the first thing we do is we track people to their in and out breath for a couple minutes, but as we make that list of safety.
A question here from Anne, who writes, can you share any surprising findings from your work with first responders using neurosculpting?
Yes. The surprising finding is that most of them don't want to be the people they've become. And most of them are so ready and receptive to meditation. So what I experienced was a big ego hit. I started working with first responders 10 years ago, and I went in thinking, I don't know if they're ready for this. And what I found was, yeah, they are. They just needed to hear it in their language. And my ego of, I have something secret to share with them, I'm going to enlighten them, was laughable. Because what I found was they were ready. They could drop in like that as long as they were communicated to in a way that they could hear. Meaning I was not allowed to say the word meditation. I had to say something else. I had to call it a mental exercise. But then they could meditate. And what I found was that most of them want to tap in. They want to regulate. They don't want to become hardened by their job. They don't want to lose their compassion. They don't want to alienate their friends and family. And they don't want to profile. They don't. I can say at this point I've worked with probably over 2,000 officers. And I've met one who was hateful. One. And he was sure to write me a hateful letter to prove that he was hateful. But I met 1,999 that were begging to be taught how to tap into their emotional regulation system, because they wanted to be compassionate in their lives. That was surprising to me. I thought I would have to fight more to get them to want that. But they want it. And they don't know who to ask. And they certainly don't want to risk looking vulnerable, so they don't ask. But they actually want it. That was a huge surprise for me.
Lisa, a question from Kim, who writes in, any suggestions or precautions in bringing the suggestions you've offered in this session to children?
I would say that shaking seems pretty universally safe. Mapping to safety is a great idea. I would say be careful about nutrition and children, and just obviously make sure children's dietary needs are met. So for instance, like one of the questions earlier was the ketones. You know, if you've got a child with epilepsy, you may not want to do equal amounts of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. If you've got a child with autism and certain proteins stimulate autistic response. So I would say maybe in the nutrition phase, bring in an educated nutrition person to help you make those changes if the child needs that. But in terms of those other suggestions, they're pretty universal.
Lisa, as we come to a conclusion here of this session, I'd love it if you'd be willing to take us through a neurosculpting practice together in real time, where all of us here that are participating in the broadcast can track along with you. And maybe we can work with something that is a pervasive sense that I think many people have of not feeling safe, something like anxiety. Like, we have a sense of anxiety, we can feel it in our body. Could you take us through a full neurosculpting practice that we could do together right now?
I can. So I would say, are we good for 15 minutes?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So this is a 15-minute practice. Now, I just want to make a caveat. If you are not in a position to close your eyes during this practice right now as you're listening, please don't be dangerous and close your eyes. If you're comfortable and in a safe environment to close your eyes, then I'm going to recommend that. And so let's just get comfortable then for a 15-minute practice. And I'm just going to invite you to gently close your eyes and not worry at all about clearing your thoughts or finding bliss or anything like that. I'm going to invite you for just the next moment to notice your breath. Noticing that as you breathe in, parts of your body expand like lungs and ribs and belly. And as you breathe out, your body releases. And I wonder what you might notice about your breath. Maybe you notice its speed, or maybe you trace it with your awareness into the body. How far in can you trace it? How far out of the body can you follow it? And as you breathe and observe this familiar and repeating in and out process, you might notice that no matter what your thoughts are, and whether you're aware of it or not, your breath breathes itself in each and every moment. And this in and out wave-like pattern continues. And with just a little awareness, you might even be comfortable enough to increase the length of the inhale or the exhale or both. Breathing in and out, noticing that your breath can deepen on its own, and your body can mold itself around your deepening breath. I wonder how much more contact you might notice between your body and the chair. Maybe your bones get heavier as you breathe just a bit deeper. And I wonder in this moment what you might focus on that's comfortable or safe. Maybe it's the solid ground holding you up. Maybe it's the fact that in this one moment in time, you are sheltered from the elements. Maybe you notice that you have access to basic resources if you need them, or perhaps it's just that you are able-minded and able-bodied enough to do this exercise in this moment. And with your basic needs and that list in your mind, in your breath breathing itself, I wonder how you might spark a little curiosity in your brain. What is the most interesting shape you could ever imagine? Maybe one you've never even seen before. Or perhaps you imagine your name spelled backwards and how that might sound in this moment if you tried to say it. Or you might even find it interesting to try to bring your awareness to one eyelash on your left eye. Wonder what that might be like. And from this space, with your breath breathing itself, with your basic needs met, with your mind extra curious, you can be assured that anything that happens in this meditation is for you to embrace or discard or adapt in a way that serves you best. You are the author. And maybe there's a stress, S-T-R-E-S-S, that comes to mind for you. Maybe it's a word like anxiety. Maybe it's some other words like financial stress or relationship stress. Whatever your stress is, I wonder if you could choose three words that describe how this affects you. Or three words to represent this stress for you. And could you even order those words in a list of high priority to low priority, or high impact to low impact, or perhaps instead you list them in alphabetical order. Your breath is still breathing itself. What if you could take those words and represent them in your mind as though they were colors or textures, vibrations or symbols? I wonder what you might come up with. Maybe these words are dark and heavy. Maybe they're hot or red or sticky or sharp or something else. Your breath is breathing itself. Your body is supported. If you could take a little discovery through your body as though it were transparent, where might you imagine, feel, or perceive these colors to live in your space? Are the colors of stress in your chest, your gut, your neck, your pinky, or somewhere else? Breath is breathing itself. You might even notice a relationship this stress has to your body. Maybe it's a contraction or a sensation, a temperature or a thought. And because your breath is breathing itself and your body is supported, what would it be like to use your inhale to begin to loosen or release some or all of this, and your exhale to escort it out of your space into some receptacle beyond you? Maybe a garbage pail, maybe a hole in the ground, maybe a fire pit, maybe a box that you could lock. Imagining this on the in and out breath. And maybe we're not ready to release everything we've discovered, but perhaps releasing one tiny bit is better than none at all. The smallest of bits to the largest. Maybe you even notice something about the nature of this release. And if you've noticed release of this old stress story in any way, felt it, perceived it, imagined it, and you'd like to remember this release, you're invited to tap those areas with your non-dominant hand if that's comfortable, or maybe you prefer tapping your thumb to fingertips. Linking this simple gesture to this perception that you can release this stress. And I wonder how tapping like this tomorrow might remind you of this moment today. Breath is still breathing itself. And maybe you notice something about your space now. And maybe there's even a word that means something to you, or maybe a word that's just so nonsensical that it strikes you as funny, that you could use to remind you of the most important parts of this experience. What would you name this? And perhaps even saying, writing, reading, or hearing this word tomorrow might also remind you of this experience right here. And in a few more breaths, you can begin to bring your awareness from the inner landscape to the outer. taking a moment to bring gentle movement into fingers and toes. And whenever you feel ready, you can end your meditation and open your eyes.
Very good. Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you for giving us a real taste of real-time neurosculpting together, all of us here that are participating in the Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to spend this time with all of you.
Lisa Wimberger on how we can use neuroscience to help us both with healing and finding more evaluative happiness in our lives. This concludes the second live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you, Lisa Wimberger, and thank you everyone for joining us. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible and for free for 24 hours. If you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. Please join us for our next live session, which will be with Kelly McGonigal on the neuroscience of change. This will be taking place tomorrow, March 21st, at noon Eastern Time. Again, for Sounds True, my name's Tammy Simon. Thanks everyone for being with us. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. All right.